The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 113, entitled How to Reverse Alzheimer's and Other Diseases, I chat with scientist, biohacking pioneer, and chemist Steve Fowkes. Steve shares with us his best tips for optimizing your health, improving your brain function, and reversing diseases like Alzheimer's. He dives into many fascinating subjects and the protocols he comes up with to maximize your well-being and overcome crippling health problems. Steve talks about reversing Alzheimer's, fighting off Parkinson's, and becoming the healthiest version of yourself. If you're wondering how you can overcome crippling diseases like Alzheimer's, or just dramatically improve your health in a number of very important ways, this episode is for you and you're going to love it. And by the way, Steve is going to be back on the show in just a few weeks because we had so much fun doing this episode, we had to double down and bring him back on for another one. So enjoy this episode. I know you guys are going to love it. Hey man, I got a couple quick reminders I want to share with you. First, the Elite Man Podcast is available on all podcasting channels, including iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and directly on the EliteManMagazine.com website. You can subscribe to any or all of these channels to get every episode as soon as they're available, and I highly recommend you do so. Also, our show notes are always up on the EliteManMagazine.com website for you to check out more info on every podcast we have. This includes the summary of each episode, any links for products, recommendations, or resources we mention, and further info on that episode. And finally, if you're not on our Elite Man newsletter yet, join today at EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter. You'll get all of our podcast episodes, articles, videos, and special content not seen or heard on the site or show. Join the newsletter now, EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Steve Fowkes. Steve, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Great to be here.
Steve, can you just tell our audience a little, maybe in, you know, take 60 seconds or, you know, a couple minutes just to talk about what it is you do exactly? We do, I mean, I gave the listeners a bit of an intro a minute ago, but I want to hear it from your perspective exactly what you do, because I'm fascinated by a lot of the things you do, and you kind of cover a good amount of different subjects. But where did this kind of all start, and what do you do now?
Well, I've always been the kind of kid growing up that liked to take things apart and put them back together again just to see how they work. And I had an interest in chemistry and went off to college to study chemistry, and that is kind of like taking the human body apart and putting it back together and understanding all the metabolic pathways and just having a fundamental curiosity about that. And when my grandfather developed Alzheimer's disease when I was in college, it hit me hard emotionally, and so I shifted from just understanding metabolism to looking at neurodegenerative diseases and aging phenomena themselves. And it's led me into all kinds of different directions and, you know, stuff that I would have had no idea that I was going to get into it back at that point in time. But it's been a lifelong avocation to, you know, figure out, you know, what the basis of health is and what the basis of disease is.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And where do you fall on that spectrum of, you know, your belief in doctors and kind of the American, you know, Medical Association in this point in time? Is it, you mean, are you kind of anti-doctor, anti-establishment, or is it more like, you know, they have a good purpose and they're doing well? I mean, kind of some people hate doctors, some people
love doctors, and then some people kind of fall in between. Where are you on that?
Well, I love doctors and am very anti-establishment. The institutions of medicine are very dysfunctional, and doctors are educated in a very inhumane way. And doctors have, you know, attitudes like, if that worked, we would know about it. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times people have told me that doctors have said that to them. And it's absolutely ludicrous. Never in the history of the planet have all the things that work been known by doctors. And we can look back, you know, 20 years ago and 40 years ago and 200 years ago and look at what doctors did and recognize the folly of it. So, you know, there's a lot to criticize in terms of people looking for answers to things. You come in with a set of deep medical problems and the doctor spends, you know, quite a bit of time looking at your labs and studying things and goes, I don't know what's going on. And, you know, that's very nice to have that kind of honesty. But a lot of doctors don't even have that degree of honesty. They'll, you know, describe it as something that it isn't, or they will say there's nothing wrong with you, or learn to live with it, or refer you to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, and then, you know, you're kind of left on your own anyways, trying to figure out what's wrong with you or trying a million different things, or maybe you never figure it out, like, you know, I think too many people kind of end up doing, which is, you know, obviously very unfortunate. So what is the website you have now, and what's the work you do on the site?
Well, I don't do a lot of maintenance on websites at this point in time. Mainly I use other platforms like, for example, Quora, or doing podcasts with people like you. But, you know, CERI.com, CERI.com, the Cognitive Enhancement Research Institute, is a repository for about 10 years of work that I did in the area of smart drugs. The Project Wellbeing site was created after that, and I have a page there that links, for example, my book on how to use an FDA-approved food preservative to treat viral diseases of all kinds. So there's you know, blogging there, and there's free downloads there, much of which has been the book on BHT has been 40 years of research in the making of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And how I guess do you make your living, or how have you made your living over the past few decades or so?
Well, I've done a lot of different things. I certainly work with people one-on-one through individual consultations and family consultations. I've done product designs for companies for different kinds of formulas. I have an alcohol detox formula that I gave to a doctor in Texas who handed it off to Nutrition Dynamics, where you can take this when you're drinking and pretty much avoid hangovers.
Wow, that's really cool.
But I also have a technology side as a chemist, and so for the last, you know, 15 years or so, I've been in material science, and I have a nanotechnology company where I'm developing a means of building nanoscale molecules that potentially in the future could be medically useful for example, having little devices that go through your bloodstream and clean out plaque out of your arteries, or might be able to recognize and kill cancer cells in some way. Mm-hmm. So I have a fairly rich life, and I can say honestly that I'm never bored.
Yeah, I was listening to one of the podcasts, and Dave Asprey said that you're like his go-to guy if he has any questions related to health, science, biohacking, nootropics, any of this stuff. He like goes to you when he can't figure stuff out. So I mean, that just kind of show. I mean, it, to me, it was like, you know, eye-opening to hear that. You know, you're his go-to guy, a guy that pretty much knows everything there is to know, or as much as there is to know as far as, you know, I'm concerned about biohacking, things like that. One of the smartest guys in the world. You're his go-to guy. So, I mean, you are the guy to go to when it comes to this stuff. You're the established figure. And he was even saying that you were kind of the first biohacker to come out. And this was, you know, decades ago before biohacking was even a thing or anyone even knew about it. So, I mean, is that true? Were you kind of like the pioneer in this industry?
Well, I was certainly way ahead of my time. I was doing biohacking when it wasn't popular and nobody really knew what it was. But I certainly was no means the first. And biohacking has been going on in the world probably before I was born, although sometimes it's hard to really get a handle on that. But I would look at certain people who were scientists and figuring out how the body worked and, you know, the Krebs cycle, for example, and Ravisi's work on metabolic typing, and that's basically biohacking. More from a scientific point of view, I think that in the last 40 years that biohacking has become personal. It's become an individual effort for people to hack their own health and what I call self-care technologies, which I have been cultivating for a long time, a lot because of what you described earlier in terms of resistance to the blindnesses of the medical profession, recognizing where they're gifted and where they're not. And self-care technologies give us personal control over our health investigations, which for a lot of people makes a huge difference in their orientation towards having a disease.
So, Steve, I wanted to ask you about a few of the topics we covered. We mentioned a minute ago, and then some of the things we mentioned off call as well. But first, like, what was the first, I guess, experience for you where you realized you had to kind of figure things out on yourself? I remember when I was about 16 years old, 17, I had this really bad tendonitis in my elbow, tennis elbow and golfer's elbow. So I had it on in and outside the elbow, and I tried everything, man, for about 6 months. I went to a bunch of doctors. You know, they gave me the rice treatment, you know, the ice rest, Elevate, all that stuff. None of it worked. They put me on some ultrasound thing. Didn't help. Tried a bunch of different pads for it to kind of help with it, to like straighten it out and stuff, different things to put on it. Nothing worked. And then I stumbled upon this little ebook online that actually talked about eccentric lifting. And I did this on my own for about 4 to 6 weeks and completely cured it by myself. And then I started taking things like fish oil and some other stuff and haven't had a problem with tendonitis since then. So, I mean, that was a huge like shift in my whole perspective on this sort of self-treatment and care thing. Was there something like that that happened to you, man?
No, there wasn't. It is notable because most of the people that I consider my colleagues have been through similar kinds of things where there was a health crisis that forced them to get real about things. And I can't say that I've ever had anything like that. My introduction to self-care testing and all was just curiosity driven, where I started playing with amino acids and looking at neurotransmitters. And then I discovered antioxidants and the free radical theory of aging and started, you know, playing around with things. So for me, I didn't come at it through that route, but I have to say most people do.
Mm-hmm. So, and I have to admit to some, hearing some of the conversations you've had, it seems like you're a lot more bold than I would ever be. I've tried a ton of different minerals, vitamins, supplements, but I feel like you've tried literally everything under the sun when it comes to that stuff, plus, you know, all the smart drugs and nootropics. What are you kind of thinking like when you try these things? Are you ever like worried that it's going to like backfire?
Yeah, I think I went from being very conservative in grade school and high school to being very radical in college. And I can't say I know why that transition happened. Maybe it was just some kind of a cultural transplantation of going off to college and kind of uprooting myself and replanting myself that helped me make that transition. I really don't know, but it's true that I feel very comfortable trying a lot of different things that would give other people pause. And maybe it's because I understand the chemistry, and therefore I do have a connection to the experiment on that kind of chemistry knowledge level.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're just kind of taking, you know, you hear a new supplement or a drug and you just kind of like blindly take it, right? There's a lot of research before you do something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much so.
Have you ever had like a really adverse reaction to taking something?
Oh, yes.
What
sure.
was that? What was like one of the worst ones?
Well, you know, I kind of have used my body as a analytical tool. So there was a point in time when I was writing about Deprenil, which is a great smart drug for men, for aging men, middle-aged and older men. And, you know, at that point in time, there was a single brand of Deprenil that was approved in the United States called Eldepril. And getting it was a problem because the drug was really only prescribed for people with Parkinson's disease. And aging men, most of them don't have Parkinson's disease. And so a lot of this was being a lot of Deprenil was being imported from Europe under the FDA's personal use importation guidelines. And I was one of those people doing that. And there were several companies overseas that were selling it. And I had my concerns about what it was that was being sold, especially by one company called, I think it was Interlab, which was being promoted by the Life Extension Foundation. Well, I at that point in time, I was experimenting with Deprenil and taking it fairly regularly, but in a very small dose, less than a milligram a day. And normal therapeutic dose is 5 milligrams. And so I had been taking it for a while, so I knew what it was like. And I had tried 2 milligram doses, and that was definitely too much. I became edgy and various kinds of obsessive ideation and compulsive tendencies would become more troublesome to me, and it would actually start to get into the way of my sleep. So I decided at one point that I was going to test this Deprenil from this one company and compare it to Deprenil from another company. So I took 5 milligrams, which is a huge dose. Mm-hmm. And this what turned out to be kind of counterfeit Deprenil. It was very toxic. It was irritating. It became very dysfunctional. I wasn't able to write for 2 days. I slept fitfully, but it wasn't that arousing, and it was a very toxic experience. And a week later, I took 5 milligrams of a high quality Deprenil, an entirely different experience. It's true that I had difficulty sleeping that night, and very, very vivid dreams and colorful dreams and frenetic dreams. But on the whole, I was able to write. I was able to work. And the following night, I went to sleep normally. And so it even though it wasn't an experience that I would say I liked, it certainly wasn't a nasty experience like the other product was. So, you know, that's an example of how you can do something, you know, on the basis of being a reporter and wanting to write about a subject, and doing something that on some level, you know, maybe this compound actually had something that was neurotoxic and it might have actually done some damage to me. But, you know, I did it. You know, looking back at it now, I might not.
That's awesome, man. So do you kind of chalk that up to the fact that it was like a counterfeit Deprenil, or was it the fact that you took 5 milligrams of it?
Well, the second time, a week after it, I took 5 milligrams of a high-quality Deprenil, so I repeated the experience. That's that's the science geek, you know, saying yeah. 5 milligrams of this supposed Deprenil with 5 milligrams of stuff that I know is Deprenil so that I can compare them to each other experientially, where I actually know what dopamine feels like. So Deprenil produces dopamine. L-Dopa produces dopamine. There's some herbs that produce dopamine. So I knew what dopamine felt like in my mind, in my behaviors, in my being. And so it gave me a perspective of judging these two products.
Mm-hmm. Do you encourage others to kind of be experimental like yourself, or do you kind of caution other people to be, you know, just, I guess, safer about what they're taking?
Well, I caution other people to be safer than me, but I think on some level, you know, I really do have some kind of an intuitive sense of risk. And so, you know, that was an example of something that I considered at the time to be an acceptable risk that looking back on it, I might not. And I think the same thing would be true of back when I was painting houses and working on top of, 35 foot high, ladders and planks and stuff like that. In my older age, I would never consider doing that. But at the time, it seemed perfectly reasonable.
That's a riot, man. So the D'Epernil, I think you mentioned too that this is or can be a good treatment for something like Parkinson's. Is that right?
Well, that's its main prescribed use. It slows down the development and progression of Parkinson's disease very dramatically.
And how does it work?
Well, it works by inhibiting an enzyme that breaks down dopamine in support cells throughout the brain. So a lot of drugs, in a sense, produce that same kind of an effect in all cells, and this is selective for particular kinds of cells, and so it seems to enhance the way one class of cell in the brain protects other cells in the brain that relate specifically to the use of the dopamine neurotransmitter, which is involved with motivation, drive, competitiveness, sex, achievement. It regulates the part of your brain that motivates you to do something. And that motivation can be recognizing when things aren't good and I want to, the grass is greener on the other side of the hill, which can be a very good thing for somebody who might otherwise be stuck in complacency or apathy. As men age, we tend to lose a variety of influences that we have in large quantities when we're young, and everybody focuses on testosterone. But it turns out that dopamine is as critical to male sex drive and competitiveness as testosterone is, and it doesn't get the same degree of focus. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many middle-aged and older men have tried D'Epernil and wouldn't think about not doing it anymore.
Cool. So you're saying dopamine for older men especially is just as important, if not more, than testosterone?
Yes. In terms of that being connected to that maleness and masculinity, and whether or not you look at it as sexuality or you look at it as competitiveness or achievement, but that having a goal in life to leave a legacy, having passion for living. That part of being male is definitely connected to dopamine. And it's not just in men. I think men have a lot more of their identity attached to achievement and competitiveness than women do. But for women who use D'Epernil, many of them really like it, not just because of, any kind of sex secondary benefits, but because they get a certain level of assertiveness out of it, and many women really appreciate that.
I want to jump back to the Parkinson's topic in a moment. But first, what are the and by the way, we're going to be kind of jumping around a lot in today's episode. I'm absolutely fascinated by so many of these different topics, and I know you're the guy to talk to, so I want to get as much answers out of you as possible, Steve, so I appreciate it, man. But what are some of the healthy levels of dopamine that you should look for if you're going to get like tested and kind of think if maybe you need to supplement with something like this?
Well, it's very difficult to measure dopamine because the only really reliable way to do it is a spinal tap or a brain biopsy, and those are not trivial procedures. So when you look at dopamine levels in terms of neurotransmitter precursor or metabolites in the urine, you're looking at the entire body, not just what's going on in the central nervous system. So neurotransmitters can be misleading on that level. So I don't think I have a rule about that in the same sense that if somebody were to ask me what's the right level of testosterone to have, I would say it depends on whether you're a low testosterone man with high testosterone sensitivity or a high testosterone man with low testosterone sensitivity. The readings are going to be different, and you need to know what kind you are. And the way to determine that is to try it on like you would a suit or some clothing and look at yourself in a mirror to see, do you like the cut? Do you like the color? You know, all that kind of stuff. And so you experiment with, for example, Deprenil at different doses, slowly ramp it up over time, and then maybe even ramp it back down again so that you can observe yourself in action to see what qualities does this bring to your life and are they good or bad?
Mm-hmm. Is the same, so you do the same thing with testosterone too? You would just try like different, what is it, micrograms that they give out or milligrams? You just test it out for a number of weeks or months?
Yeah. With testosterone, there is a backup plan in terms of testing where you want to analyze what happens to your estrogen, estradiol, and estrone. So testosterone converts into both the hydrotestosterone and estradiol. And so if you have a significant amount of inflammation in your lives, and if you live in a modern life, you know, you're likely to have that kind of thing. The level of aromatase can be elevated from inflammation, and that can convert a lot of your testosterone into estradiol, which then hangs around and obstructs the effects of the testosterone.
Cool. Definitely, you know, kind of getting into some scientific stuff, but, you know, I hope our listeners can at least appreciate, some of the general things you're saying, but, so, I mean, even if you're listening now and you don't quite understand everything Steve or I go over, I think generally speaking, you can get kind of the overall message. And if you have any follow-ups, of course, you can always, you know, email me at, Justin at Elite Man Magazine. I'll see what I can do as far as answering some individualized questions. So the dopamine levels, tough to check. You need something like a spinal tap to really get like an accurate reading on that, but you can kind of play around and see, you know, how you feel on this. Same thing with testosterone. Is there kind of like a gen? I mean, I always hear with testosterone, something like 800 or whatever is like the good kind of level to be at, and most guys are like, you know, hovering 500-600. Is there any kind of substance to that, or is that just like some random number people throw out?
That's a good number for somebody who's a high testosterone man with low testosterone sensitivity. But if you're a low testosterone man, 500 is high.
Okay. So, and then how many guys are low and with high sensitivity, and then, you know, vice versa? Is it kind of like 50-50, or is it like more like one-sided?
I don't know. That's a good clinical question for somebody who is a clinician. I have no idea.
Okay. But you do know that it's, you know, people kind of have that issue, and it's regular enough for them to want to check it.
Yes. And, you know, the same thing can be said for dopamine. One of the things that I learned in studying neurotransmitters in myself, I ended up writing some articles about it called The Designer Brain, which is basically saying that you can explore all your neurotransmitters and levels and find out, you know, by your own responses and your own responses in the context of your own values, whether or not you like or dislike different kinds of things. And I found out that I was a high dopamine man, and I'm a high choline man, a cholinergic man. So I'm cholinergically dominant, and I'm dopaminergically dominant. So if I supplement those, I can get into trouble because I can easily take too much. So the amount of Deprenil that I take is about 25% to 35% of what an average man my age would be taking. And the same thing is true of DMAE, dimethylaminoethanol, which raises acetylcholine levels in the brain and is used to you know, as a smart drug ingredient. If I take 131 milligrams of that, which is a standard one capsule size, I can get a headache. It's just too much for me.
Have you joined the best Facebook group on the planet yet? If not, what the hell is wrong with you? Just kidding. If not, join right now. You are missing out. We have hundreds of awesome, awesome guys in this group every single day sharing their best tips, strategies, advice, and techniques for becoming the best man they can be and you could be. If you're looking to improve, say, your dating, your health, your fitness, your business, your confidence, your social skills, your style, any one of these key areas that goes into being a man, this is the Facebook group for you. you. Everyone in the group is so connected, and we share our best advice and just helpful strategies throughout the week in becoming the best men we can be. Go to EliteManMastermind.com, and it will forward you right to our Facebook group. Or you could just go right on Facebook and just search Elite Man Mastermind in the search bar. Either way works, EliteManMastermind.com, or search Elite Man Mastermind right on Facebook. But you have to join this group. It is unbelievable the amount of quality men in this group, and it's unbelievable how we're all helping each other out and helping each other become the best men we can be every single day. It's the best way to be connected with other like-minded guys and the best way to be part of this elite man community that's growing and growing. And man, I look forward to connecting with you and furthering our conversation and getting to know you on a much better level. So join me in the group. It's EliteManMastermind.com, or just type it right in the search bar, Elite Man Mastermind, when you go on Facebook. I know you're all on Facebook. Everyone's on Facebook. I'm on Facebook every single day, and I love this group, and it is such an awesome community of guys. So I look forward to seeing you there, EliteManMastermind.com.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that too, and it's definitely a great point you bring up as far as like knowing, you know, the individualized approach for yourself and what you can tolerate as opposed to other people. I remember, I think I was about 17, 18 again. This is kind of when I all generally started getting into the whole self-help, self-improvement, you know, taking supplements, working on myself era in my life. One of the first things I ever took was a multivitamin from GNC, and this was way back when too. And I just remember picking it up from the guy at the, you know, the cashier at the store. He recommended it. He's like, you know, this is our new supplement. And he even said, yeah, I asked him what a multivitamin was, because I was getting like a protein shake at the time. And he, you know, threw this as an add-on to kind of upsell me or whatever. And of course, I bought it. And he's like, I remember this is kind of how dated this is. I didn't even know what a multivitamin was at the time. So I was like 17 or something. And he's like, oh, it's, you know, the healthiest thing you can take. You know, it's great. It has all the, you know, vitamins and stuff. It's going to make you healthier, stronger. And I was sold and I bought it, took it. As it turns out, the multivitamin that he gave me was a really, I don't know what it was high in. Again, I wish I had the bottle, because I save a lot of the old bottles I have, even if I don't take them. I don't have that bottle in front of me anymore. I must have thrown it out years ago. But I don't know what it was high in, but it was high in a number of different things I didn't need. And I was taking it, and I actually, I don't know if it, I'm like 99% sure it was related to this, but soon after taking it, within like, you know, a few days after regularly taking it, I started getting sleep paralysis. And I would get sleep paralysis every single day. And I didn't even connect the two at first. It was only till about 3-4 weeks later where I, you know, thought maybe, oh, maybe it's the multivitamin or something. There's something in there I should stop taking. And I stopped taking that, and actually coincidentally had been just started taking magnesium, because I was dealing with anxiety at the time. And the magnesium, I stopped taking the multivitamin, and then like around the exact same time, like maybe within a day or two, started taking the magnesium, and the sleep paralysis completely went away.
It could have been that you were taking a 2-to-1 calcium to magnesium ratio, and it was driving your magnesium further and further into the cellar. There are people who, you know, parasympathetic oriented, who do need high calcium, but if you're sympathetic order dominant, you need more magnesium, and so a 2-to-1 ratio is inappropriate for somebody who's sympathetic dominant.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you can kind of understand, you know, what was happening here. You know, if it was something like a 2-to-1 calcium ratio, or maybe it was some other type of because it was one of those multivitamins that just had like a ton of different crap in it, like a ton of different herbs and just adaptogens and just crazy stuff that I think most 17-year-old young men don't need, plus all the other high levels of vitamins. And then, you know, I was kind of eating healthy anyway, so I was, like I said, I was going through this, like, you know, self-help thing where I was just, you know, doing everything right. And so whether it was that, the 2-to-1 calcium, which, you know, if you say it is, I tend to believe you, or something else. But it was just crazy how it happened. Then I just started taking magnesium, and it was like, whoa, this thing's completely gone now. I mean, you know what's weird, though, is every once in a while, maybe every once a year or every 6 months to every once in a year, I'll get sleep paralysis even now, which is weird. But and by the way, it's scary as hell for anyone who's never had it.
Yes, it's true. And it could be that you have some constitutional or congenital development that makes you sensitive to that much more than an average person. You know, that's why it's useful to get a genetic analysis of your polymorphisms or study psychology and find out what Enneagram type you are, what Jungian type you are, or, you know, look at your metabolism, find out if you're a fast or slow oxidizer, whether you're a sympathetic or parasympathetic type, or whether or not you're anabolic or catabolic type, according to Ravisi's model. The more you study these kinds of things and figure out what's going on, the better you can make wise health decisions in your life.
Thanks, man. What was I kind of just went right over my head when you said it. What was the genetic diagnosis name for it?
Well, 23andMe are the people that I used, and it's like $99 to get, you know, thousands and thousands of genetic variations tested, the most common types, but it's not necessarily all of them. But if you find out that you've got an MTHFR mutation that you carry because some of your ancestors were from Northern Europe, then that means that you can have a disturbance in your folic acid metabolism. And if you know about it, you might make a better decision about, for example, if you have anemia, treating it with some obscure kind of folic acid instead of taking iron supplements.
Cool. And so that's 23andMe. That's the website that you do?
Yeah. 23andme.com, and it was like $99. I don't know if it's still the same price, but there are other services that do the same kind of thing. I mean, this is now the age when getting your polymorphisms, in other words, the variable parts of your DNA analyzed, is now $100 or so, and getting your full genome done is like, you know, $1,000 or $2,000. And these things, you know, a full genome would have been $1 million 10 to 20 years ago, and you wouldn't have been able to get polymorphism testing, you know, 20 to 40 years ago. This is all the pace of the evolution of science and technology. The cost of sensors and detectors and equipment is plummeting. The cost of computer analysis of massive quantities of data is plummeting. And so we are now at the age of the sensor, and you can go out and buy a wristwatch that will monitor your pulse rate and your galvanic skin response and maybe your body temperature and be able to make predictions about how well you're sleeping and whether or not you're having some kind of panic disorder or anxiety attack. This idea of wearables is now makes this whole idea of biohacking largely transparent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was speaking to Josh Trent a few months back, and he's big on the technology, like the Fitbits and all that stuff. He's even saying that there's one of those ones, I don't know if it's Fitbit or one of the other ones, that you can, it tells you like whether or not you should exercise for the day. Like it can check your stress levels and your heartbeat and all that other stuff, and actually decide for you if it's healthy or not to exercise. Because some people, you know, they want to train all the time, or maybe they're a little sick, and they want to kind of just keep pushing themselves, but they can actually do more harm when they do this kind of thing. And like this new technology, this whatever wristwatch or whatever it was, actually can like help you decide and like really give you a good understanding of, you know, whether or not you should actually push yourself or not, that day or not.
Very true. Heart rate variability is a powerful technology that looks at the way the brain center in your heart, the cluster of nerves in your heart, communicates with your brain stem through the vagus nerve. And this is a very, very powerful two-way communication, and it tells you the degree to which you might be anxious or fearful, you might be activated, you might be suspicious, or you're relaxed and calm. And this has a big effect on, for example, the quality of your digestion. So if you eat a meal, you want to be calm when you eat that meal.
So going back to what you said earlier with the Deprenyl for Parkinson's, has there been any like studies or anything? Have people been any like people been cured by this kind of thing, like from their Parkinson's if they already have it now, or is it kind of just in like the ground stages of it?
Well, Deprenil, as far as I know, isn't really intended as a cure for Parkinson's. It's intended to slow down the process. And so, you know, unlike Alzheimer's disease, where when you get your first symptoms, your brain has flipped from a non-Alzheimer's state into an Alzheimer's state, Parkinson's disease involves cumulative damage that doesn't manifest in symptoms until there's a lot of accumulated damage. But with Parkinson's disease, it's a much bigger challenge to reverse it than Alzheimer's disease, because Alzheimer's disease is like a switch. It just kind of suddenly turns on because of a metabolic change. And if you know what caused that metabolic switch to flip, you can flip it back, and the brain basically restores anywhere from 90% to 99% of its function, depending upon how long it's been and how much damage has accumulated before you flip the switch back again. I've seen people respond for reversal of Alzheimer's disease to such an extent that some people can't tell that they ever had it.
Wow, that's incredible. So I want to dive into that in a moment. But let's stick with the Parkinson's too for just for another minute or two. So the Parkinson's you're saying is a lot harder because there's a lot more things going on with it. Is that right?
Yes. The dopamine nervous system ages more rapidly than other parts of the brain. And that's because the dopamine neurotransmitter has, well, the chemical term would be 2-hydroxy groups on it, and other neurotransmitters only have one or none. And that makes dopamine a kind of antioxidant. It's in a part of the brain called the substantia nigra, which means black. Nigra means black. And if you were to do an autopsy on a brain and look at that part of the brain, you're going to see, in effect, it's black. And if you trace the neuron flows, you can see these black traces throughout the brain. And that's because the dopamine is converting into a melanin pigment as a byproduct of free radical activity. So on some level, Parkinson's disease manifests there after that kind of damage has been going on for quite a while, and you just don't know it because you don't have shaking hands yet, or you don't have slowed movement yet. But by the time you have 50% damage and you start to see symptoms, it's almost impossible to reverse that 50% with the kind of technology that we have at our disposal right now. But with stem cell therapies in the near future, and understanding neuroprotective mechanisms that relate to the cultivation of your own stem cell technology, you know, cells that are in your body, we may be able to reverse that to a very significant extent at some point in the near future. Let's talk about Alzheimer's disease a bit, because you know you mentioned it in the context of Parkinson's disease, and I think that it's still highly controversial. I think the vast majority of people listening to this will be of the belief that Alzheimer's disease is still uncurable, and that's just not the case anymore. And it's not just because I have an insight and have been reversing Alzheimer's disease in a handful of people over the last 10 years, but because Dale Bredesen of UCLA and the Buck Institute for Aging is now reversing Alzheimer's disease in more than 100 people with remarkable success. So it's now transitioning out of being fringe to being part of experimental medical practice, where it's an actual study being conducted with good results.
What was the name of the doctor again? I want to add that to the show notes.
Dale Bredesen, Bredesen. He's the current president and founding member of the Buck Institute of Aging up in Marin County, and he's a professor of medicine at UCLA, and he's been doing this study for at least 5 years, enough to be able to provide early reports on its success. And he's getting good results on the time frame of a year of therapy.
Wow, that's incredible. So what is this protocol? What's he doing?
it's basically the same kind of stuff I'm doing, only he's bringing to bear a much higher kind of medical testing, and he basically classifies Alzheimer's people into five different categories, each one of which has a different kind of primary trigger. So there are people for whom it's simply a metabolic insufficiency, and they need some kind of thyroid or vitamin D to raise their metabolic rate. There are people who might be environmentally sensitive to fungal toxins, for example, he just has a much more thorough methodology. My approach is trial and error to figure out how to raise people's metabolism, and sometimes I'm lucky and guess well, and other times I'm not, and sometimes I get very, very good compliance, and other times people don't comply at all.
So you're kind of working on like maybe a couple of the things that he's working on. You said he has like five things to do. You're working on like the metabolic.
He has dozens of things that he does, wow. But he's got five different types. So for example, insulin resistance is a direct link to diabetes and to Alzheimer's disease. And so one of his groups is somebody who specifically has Alzheimer's disease because of their insulin resistance. In order to reverse insulin resistance, you basically have to cut out the carbs and start encouraging beta oxidation, which is energy metabolism, and ketosis, which is wholesale energy enhancement through fat metabolism. And it's not that hard to do, but for somebody who's addicted to carbohydrates, it can be an immense challenge to implement that kind of program.
So that's just one example of the kind of the ways that the Alzheimer's will form is through like insulin resistance. Is there a couple other ones?
Yeah. Hypothyroidism. It could be toxicity from mercury, lead, pesticide exposure, mycotoxins, formaldehyde in your environment. There's so many different things that play to our energy metabolism, and aging is one of them. We lose about a third of 1% of our energy every year that we live. And eventually, if our energy drops below a certain threshold for the defense of our antioxidant system, then the glutathione, which is our primary cellular antioxidant, loses control of mercury, and that mercury leaks out and decimates a whole class of enzymes that have that same sulfur atom as glutathione actually at the enzyme site itself or next to the enzyme site itself. So in a sense, glutathione is a sponge for mercury in our human body, and as long as we have more glutathione than mercury, our sponge isn't fully saturated. But as our energy browns out, our sponge gets wetter and wetter and wetter until it starts leaking mercury, and that causes Alzheimer's disease.
What is actually happening in the brain when Alzheimer's is caused?
Well, there are three things that I've outlined that science knows about very clearly. One is that there's a backup energy path called creatine kinase. And when ATP, which is our energy molecule, is plentiful, this creatine kinase pumps ATP into a storage form called creatine phosphate. And then when energy becomes scarce, that pathway reverses. And we get about 2 seconds of backup energy from that pathway, and that fails in Alzheimer's disease. Another system that fails is the transportation infrastructure of the brain. In most of the tissues of our body, our cells are round and globular, and diffusion is a good mechanism. Your body produces something, your cell produces something in one part of the cell, and it just diffuses to other parts of the cell, and it's not necessary to actually move it from one part of the cell to the other. But in neurons, we have axons and dendrites that are incredibly long and thin. And if a microtubule, which is this transport superhighway, were the equivalent of a two-lane highway, it would run from San Diego to Maine. Wow. And when sulfur leaks out of the sponge, it wipes out this protein called beta tubulin, which is the infrastructure for this highway, and it disassembles itself into pieces. But if you mop up that mercury, you raise the energy level and you dry out your sponge and you suck up the mercury back into the sponge again, that highway system reassembles itself. So it's a potentially temporary malfunction.
Wow, that's incredible. So is that like neurogenesis going on when it'll reassemble itself?
Well, it's a healing mechanism. It's a spontaneous healing mechanism. As long as there's enough energy, it's something that happens naturally all the time with this kind of infrastructure, that something may go wrong with part of it and the body rebuilds it. And when you have mercury leaking out of your glutathione pool, it interferes with your body's ability to heal that kind of malfunction, and it stays malfunctioning. But if you can take some thyroid hormone or unload some mercury from your body or improve your antioxidants by taking vitamin C or glutathione, or you restrict your carbohydrate in your diet and go into ketosis, and boom, all of a sudden that restraint on your energy disappears, that flood of energy activates those healing mechanisms and you spontaneously recover.
Cool. And was there a third one too?
Yes. The third one is this this structural part of the brain. I mentioned these microtubules. Well, there's also a whole class of regulatory molecules that involve phosphorylation. And the brain has this massive investment of energy in phosphorylation. And every 90 seconds, the brain goes from being underphosphorylated to being overphosphorylated and back again. And those enzymes that regulate that flipping back and forth malfunction, and the brain gets stuck in a hyperphosphorylated state. And I think, a lot of people who've done some research on Alzheimer's disease will recognize the term tau protein. Mm-hmm. And when tau protein becomes overphosphorylated, it precipitates as microfibers that's observable in Alzheimer's disease. It's a midterm kind of manifestation of this kind of process. And that those tangles are, overphosphorylated tau protein that's just precipitating out. If you then restore the sponge and you soak up the mercury, the phosphorylations enzymes and the dephosphorylation enzymes start functioning again, and the cell starts its metabolic swinging back and forth again, develops its biorhythm every 90 seconds, it starts up again, and the Alzheimer's disease goes away.
That's incredible, man, for sure. Do you think this is going to be mainstream, where like Alzheimer's is going to be wiped off, the face of the earth in like 5-10 years, or do you think it's going to, kind of still be underground like it is now, where people are actually curing this, I guess, in a lot of ways you're not supposed to say cure anymore or whatever, but people are getting others to overcome this completely, like 99%, like you said. Is this going to stay underground, like most people don't know about it, or do you think it's going to be mainstream in a few years?
I think it'll take 10 years.
10?
I think most medical revolutions take 20, but this one will be 10, because the critical population are baby boomers, and baby boomers are early adopters of self-care technologies and biohacking technologies, and they have their finger on the pulse of technology, and for many different reasons, and they won't accept otherwise, and they'll even leave the country if that's what it takes to get to this kind of therapy. But because this is being done in the United States, that won't be necessary.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I like that, man, a lot, and I appreciate you sharing your take on this, and I definitely want to look more into the Dale Bredesen guy as well. He sounds fascinating. Is there other guys like him doing this kind of work, by the way? Or is he the
only one?
Yes,
but he's the only one who's done it to this degree of professionalism. Mm-hmm. There are many clinicians who, have been outside the system and reporting Alzheimer's disease reversals for the past 15 years for a variety of causes. But it's not been clear what the central mechanism was. until a group of dental researchers figured it out back in 2001 and published in 2002. So it's been 15 years since that original insight, that smoking gun, so to speak, was published in the literature. And because it was dental researchers who published it, none of the Alzheimer's researchers know about it.
Wow. That's incredible, man. Steve, let's just do a few more questions and sort of wrap this episode up. I know I'm going to get you back on in the next couple weeks to do another episode to follow up with you on a lot of questions and a lot of more things we didn't get to cover in this episode. But just a couple more questions, man, and then we'll kind of wrap things up, and I'll let you tell our listeners where they can find out more about you and or maybe more info to learn more. Just because we're kind of covering the ice tops of these things. Like, we haven't really dug into so many different – I mean, there's so many different avenues we could take. But, yeah, we're just giving people a good kind of brief overhead look of what's out there. So going back to the Alzheimer's kind of treatment or understanding of it, would you kind of say that it's a glutathione is one of like the primary things you have to worry about or consider as far as reversing or preventing Alzheimer's from happening, is like keeping your glutathione levels high?
Well, I would say that it's not so much about glutathione levels. It's about how efficiently you recycle your glutathione. So glutathione is constantly being used by your body as an antioxidant, and your body's energy systems recycle it. And they take the oxidized glutathione, they put hydrogen back on it, and it converts it back into reduced glutathione, which now can act as an antioxidant or can act as a mercury detoxicant. And it's that loss of recycling of glutathione that makes the difference. And if you can't recycle your glutathione efficiently, it doesn't really matter if you take glutathione. It's not going to be a sustainable therapy. Your body has feedback loops that kind of set the amount of glutathione you have, and overriding that mechanism is generally difficult and most likely counterproductive.
So what are, I guess, your sort of top tips or whatever for reversing and preventing Alzheimer's in general? Like, what are the things people should focus on now if they may be worried about getting it, or if they have a parent or a grandparent who has it? What are some of the things they can do right now?
Well, one of the indicators of your metabolic rate is your body temperature. So you can see that most people with Alzheimer's disease will have cold hands and feet and a low body temperature and a low pulse rate. These are all symptoms of hypothyroidism. I have a one-pager on projectwellbeing.com on the Steve page where it goes through and lists all the different symptoms of hypothyroidism, and it outlines six different levels of thyroid testing to find out if thyroid is really malfunctioning in your body. And medical doctors typically will do one, and some of them will do two, and it's actually rare that they do all six of them. So that would be a good example of how a medical practice based on a kind of philosophical approach to testing and the ethics of testing has malfunctioned in practice. But from the perspective of how do you fix it, in the United States, I think that we are a culture of overeating, and we're specifically a culture of overeating carbs. And that gets us into insulin resistance, and insulin resistance sabotages our cellular energy production. Most of the cells in our body use insulin as a gatekeeper for glucose coming into the cell and being burned for energy. And when you become insulin resistant, that mechanism fails, so your cells brown out. You get your light dims, and therefore your recycling of glutathione dims as well. So even just doing something as simple as eating coconut oil as a food staple, working your dose up from a teaspoon a day to several tablespoons a day, can have a huge impact on your energy level. And if you can, graduate from coconut oil, which is 60% MCTs, medium chain triglycerides, to MCT oil, which is 100% triglycerides, and to go to octane oil, which is nothing but 8-carbon, you know, fat to burn, which is the most efficient, you're adding a certain level of fat burning to whatever carb burning you're doing, which might make the difference in and of itself. But if you have things like mercury fillings in your mouth and accumulated mercury in your body, or you have your lead is too high, and the average person today has about 100 times more lead than your ancestors from 10 generations ago. 100 times more lead in our bodies.
Wow.
Because we burned leaded fuel for so many years. That lead could be chelated away, but you don't really know what part of your lifestyle and what part of the toxic burden you're bearing is actually lowering your metabolism. But it, by looking at body temperature and physical strength and exercise stamina, looking at mental performance, your ability to remember, your ability to solve problems, your ability to do reaction, quick reactions, just simple reaction time. How long does it take you to put pegs on a pegboard? That can be a huge marker of how well your brain is functioning regarding glutathione. Even something like a complex decision-making test, where you have a picture of an animal and then you have the word of the animal being displayed to you, and if they match, you have a picture of a giraffe and the word giraffe, if they match, you say yes. But there's also a stoplight in the middle of the page. If it's green, you tell the truth, and if it's red, you lie. That kind of test is really simple to do, but that having to make two choices and match them together at the same time before you come up with an answer is a very good marker of how well your brain is doing.
So, like, you would do that just to see, like, where you're at and kind of, you know, maybe some of the things you should take to sort of prevent this kind of thing from happening before it gets worse?
Or reverse it if it's already happening. In other words, you use your body to tell you whether or not a lifestyle change or a supplement is a good thing or a bad thing. Your body talks to you all the time. The problem is that you are trained to speak a particular language, like English, and your body doesn't talk in English. Your body's talking to you in terms of symptoms, in terms of strength and all kinds of stuff, your stability, how well you do when you stand up suddenly, how well you exercise, how fast you tire out, how fast you react to things. Your body's talking to you all the time, but most of us never learn to speak body. So that's what biohacking is about, is learning to speak body, so that when your body talks to you, you're listening and you're paying attention, and your body will tell you what it wants.
You mentioned coconut oil, MCT, and octane oil. You said octane is the best of all three. Is that right?
Octane oil is the most efficient fat that you can burn. But if you were to spoon it down directly, it could easily irritate your mouth and your throat because it's so hyperfluid. So there's a certain tolerance issue. So I tell people to start with coconut oil and find out if you get a hint from your body that it likes this as part of your diet. If you start out with a teaspoon a day and you work up to 3 tablespoons a day, by the time you're up to 3 tablespoons, you should know from an increase in your body temperature, an increase in your mental performance, an increase in your strength, an increase in your stamina, increase in your balance, increase in proprioception. With your eyes closed, how well do you know where your finger and your nose meet? That kind of stuff is your body talking to you about whether or not it's doing well or not doing well. I mean, it's not just about that aspect of things, how quickly you think, how you feel, whether you're depressed or not, how deeply you sleep, how rested you feel when you wake up in the morning. These are all signs of what how your body is talking to you.
Cool. So it's listening to the signs and then, you know, acting appropriately. And I think one of the big takeaways, too, you mentioned was having less carbs in your diet, which, as we kind of know, it's a big problem in America and, you know, Western society. We overeat too much, and then we have too much of the bad foods, especially. What are your thoughts on something like niacin? Have you heard anything as far as Alzheimer's disease, or maybe it was Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, that it like is really good, like tests, like early, you know, preliminary tests and rats and stuff have, you know, been really good on helping rats or, you know, whatever, reverse Alzheimer's, or I think it was Alzheimer's, but it may have been Parkinson's. Have you heard anything on that?
It's probably both. Vitamin B3 turns out to have to be a vitamin for making something called NADH, and it's otherwise known as complex 1. So it's not like this minor thing. It's like, you know, this is a wire that connects the two batteries in your mitochondria together to generate the voltage that keeps you alive. So this is kind of one of the most important things that you can talk about. And it's made from niacin, and it's made from niacinamide. It's made from tryptophan. So all of those pathways are fairly inefficient, and so taking it as a supplement can make a big difference for people. And if a regular person, if you just randomly test people in the world, I'd say, you know, one in 10, one in 100 is going to respond positively to it. But if you check people with Parkinson's disease, I think probably 3 to 5 in 10 will respond positively to it. So it certainly, I think, is a triggering factor in Parkinson's disease. Any mitochondrial nutrient could easily be involved in Alzheimer's disease. B1, B2, and B3 are centrally involved. Lipoic acid is involved. Carnitine is the fat transporter to get the fat from your fat reserves into your mitochondria for burning. So you can burn coconut oil without carnitine, but you can't burn your body's fat without carnitine. So carnitine is a great thing to test, to see. Do you have more energy when you take carnitine? Take 3 grams of carnitine, test yourself. Take 6 grams of carnitine, test yourself. Take 10 grams of carnitine and test yourself. If there's absolutely no increase in temperatures, no increase in strength or stamina, no increase in your mental performance, your carnitine's probably fine, and you should look at something else. But if you respond positively to it, then it's probably contributing to your risk of Alzheimer's disease.
This is basically primarily a metabolic problem issue in the body, right? Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, or is it just Alzheimer's?
No, it's both. But Alzheimer's disease, you get symptoms at the beginning of the pathology.
Okay.
And with Parkinson's disease, the pathology is already halfway done before you get symptoms. So Parkinson's disease is certainly, in my mind, more scary.
And you said also earlier that you think in 10 years this will kind of be mainstream. Is there a timeline for when you think they'll be able to reverse Parkinson's? And any idea on that?
No. I think that the reversal of Parkinson's disease will really depend upon breakthroughs in stem cell technologies. That'll make a huge difference. And we're right on the edge of that revolution.
What is it about the stem cells you think that can reverse Parkinson's? What does it actually do, or what could it do?
It just they go into that part of the brain, and they take up residence, and they replace the dying neurons that are dead or about to die.
Okay.
Keep them alive. I mean, it's one of the interesting things about anti-aging research has been that when you take an old animal and you connect its blood supply up to a young animal so that the blood is being exchanged between the young and the old animal gets younger and the young animal gets older. So a lot of what goes on in terms of our aging manifestations is based on the environment of cells with respect to each other. And stem cells are like young cells. It's like having a young body connected to you, only they're part of your natural body. That's just in most people that are aging, it's dormant. And so the degree to which we learn to wake up those stem cells or to take them out of the body and archive them or to take them out of the body and clone them and differentiate them and then infuse them back in again or to get stem cells from a donor and put them into the body, that can make a huge difference in terms of how old our tissues are and how old they behave.
Sounds like when they figure out how to reverse Parkinson's, they're going to figure out how to basically stop time, how to reverse aging.
Well, it's certainly part of the aging spectrum, cellular aging. And so we can describe it in a lot of ways. And so that's been one of my passions is studying mechanisms of aging and how to best live to be 110 years old.
That's awesome, man.
Steve, and still having sex and still hiking in the woods and still, climbing ladders and replacing light bulbs and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and still being a badass biohacker and, you know, living on the edge, man. Steve, I appreciate you coming on, man. We're going to wrap things up. I'm definitely going to get you on again to follow up with a lot of the questions we didn't get to touch on today. But is there a place that our listeners can check out more about you, or maybe a place you want to send them to learn more info?
Well, if you just do a search on my name, you're going to be directed to all kinds of places. But Ceri, CERI.com is a repository for all the smart drug writing that I did. So if you want to know about nutritional therapy for Down syndrome or Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, that's a good place to go. If you want to see other more recent information, ProjectWellbeing.com. I blog on Quora, Quora.com. There are podcasts all over the internet. If you type my name in a search engine, you're likely to come up with a talk I gave at Google on nutrients for better mental performance. I also did a talk at Google that's on my YouTube site where I talk about Alzheimer's disease, where I give you all the same kind of information, but I go through it step by step by step. And also on that same YouTube channel, I have a 9-part series on Alzheimer's disease where it's my voice talking about a slideshow presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, where I go through all the mechanisms that are involved and lay out each of the possible bottleneck points for metabolism where it can slow down and precipitate Alzheimer's disease. So it gives you places to focus on for reversing it.
Steve, actually, right before you go, what's the one thing you want our Elite Man audience to know about, you know, whether it pertains to Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or you know, the brain in general? What's the just one kind of last message you want to leave them?
Well, for people who don't have a disease, it would be that sleep and sleep quality is probably the earliest marker of things going wrong with your body and your brain. So if you've got a sleep problem, you have a physiological problem that needs to be addressed. So that would probably be the number one message.
Okay. Thanks, man. I appreciate it, Steve. Guys, check him out. Great, you know, fascinating work he's doing. ProjectWellbeing.com or just a Google search will do it. Steve, thanks again for coming on, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Good.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.